This podcast is part of the Gonna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gonna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GonnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, the podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio, now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 75 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we grab a pint, have a laugh, and reminisce all the wacky adventures that we've had with our very old mate, an extended part of the family, the good doctor. Joining you in GPR studios this evening, my name is Keir. Thanks for joining us. With me in the studios, as always, is the omnipresent Jay. Jay, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Outstanding as well. What we're going to be doing tonight, in a continuation of our sort of expansion on the roles of the Doctor over the decades, is we're going to focus on two representative roles that the Doctor has served with relation to his companions that strike particularly emotional chords. Those of being the friend or partner through all of their adventures and experiences, and furthermore, the role of being a near, or in sometimes literal, family member.
Mm-hmm.
So while a lot of newer fans to the program might see this sort of thing as the rule of thumb, I mean, he's everyone's friend. He's always chummy with everyone, and wasn't he literally family with the Ponds because they were River's mother? So they were in-laws and so forth. But more so, it extends farther into the full scope of the show and over varying degrees as you look at it all the way from the first Doctor throughout.
Right.
So, lot to tackle.
Yeah, we do. So, this has been one of those things where you're like you mentioned, you're right. That is kind of the standard. You know, the Doctor brings on these companions and they do become friends. They form that relationship and that camaraderie. But there are some that, you know, are very, you know, they're enamored with the Doctor and he, you know, is quite fond of them. And then there's others that you really look at and be like, they definitely are friends, you know, and we've talked about it a little bit before, but the first one that really comes to mind is the Brigadier.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the kind of the standard, and obviously all the longtime GPR listeners know that there are two particular characters. Well, all right, I'll say three that are near and dear to my heart. And the Brig is absolutely the top of that list because he's the longest running recurring character in the history of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he made appearances on the program in person over 21 years and appeared with what do we count? He actually made on-screen appearances with six Doctors. And was referenced in script and in audio format to three of the others. So, mm-hmm. I talk about having a long-lasting impact on the chronology and the spread of the program. But when we talk about the companions in this case as the real friend, the mates, you know, the ones that you're really going to rely on, I sort of see it as, okay, the differentiating line for me is who would take a bullet for the Doctor,
right?
And I don't think there's anyone who would be quicker to jump into the fray, really. And I know all you Clara fans out there are going to say, well, she literally did it. But no, stop. I'm speaking in terms of the grand scheme here. As mm-hmm. far as what's been established through the program, the Brig has always been that one to jump into the fray.
Right.
And that's one of those things where, and you'd see it with the regenerations as we went from second to third and third to fourth and so on. Every time the Brigadier was introduced to another regeneration of the Doctor and they had that moment of realization, you know, there was the trepidation at first and then the walls came down and it was that old camaraderie again.
Yeah, I mean, it was that friendship that gets formed over, you know, over months, over weeks, or however, you know, however you want to term it. You know, it's those friendships that are formed over the long period of time where it's just constant exposure to this person until you realize, you know what, this is the one person I can really count on. This is, you know, I've never stopped to think about it before, but if I had a true friend, this is that person, you know. And we've all kind of experienced that at times, and that's how this was. You know, you had two people that, you know, were forced to work together that didn't really necessarily want to, but, you know, just over the course of things really grew fond of each other and were able to rely on each other, you know. And I don't know which one relied on the other one more. You know, it's like, obviously the brig was always counting on the doctor to save the day, but I think the doctor counted on the brigadier just as much, if not more.
I believe so. Well, you look at the kind of the nature of their relationship from the early inceptions at in instances with Troughton and dealing with the second doctor, the brig was sort of brought on to be his keeper. Mm-hmm. Because he was this rogue element, he was an unpredictable force, and a force to be reckoned with if left to his own devices, even though it seemed like he was completely out of control. He was very genuinely in control a great degree of the time, and the Brigadier was there to be to temper that, or to at least keep tabs on it. When you get into the relationship with the third doctor, when it finally gets sort of reestablished again, it's a very professional relationship. There's a very, very strong mutual respect in terms of their degree of control and commitment to the task. Because third doctor being very down to business, kind of, you know, your Action Jackson kind of, I'm sorry, I'm not going to say Action Jackson, that's a horrible reference. But you're get the job done, scientific superhero sort of a character. And the Brigadier was there part and parcel to be not only, you know, human relations, literally, with humans, but also to be there as part of the supporting force when things got heated. And with Pertwee, and he made more appearances, and you see Lethbridge Stewart in more Third Doctor episodes than any other as far as screen time, was a very strong working relationship as far as getting into the thick of things side by side. Mm-hmm. So by the time you get to the fourth doctor, at that point their relationship is so well established and they've been through so much together and seen such tremendous and horrendous things that their relationship is one of those ones where, you know, you see from across the room and there's that nod and a wink across the top of a pint glass because you know you've been there and done all those.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it really is a fantastic friendship that you see between the two of those. And we don't really see its like ever again. You know, the Brigadier is a singular character in this series because you don't have anyone that reaches that level of camaraderie with the Doctor. Sure, there's others that are just as close, but it's a different form. And it doesn't seem as strong. Yeah. You know,
it's probably the closest bro relationship that the Doctor has ever had. And you can say, oh, well, he had a bro relationship with Captain Jack. No, nothing like this. Oh, he had a bro relationship with Mickey when Mickey was, you know, when he really grew a pair and started getting tough. No, nothing like this.
Yeah, no.
There really isn't a kind of an equal for that sort of I'm there for you, mate kind of thing.
Right. No, I think the only one that came close to the level of respect that the Doctor gave the Brigadier was probably our next one, which was Sarah Jane.
Yeah. You can talk about another one that changed over time. Mm-hmm. I don't think – I went back and I did a lot of transcript research for this. There are no other instances where the Doctor literally refers to anyone in his company, companion or otherwise, or anyone that he refers to historically as his best friend other than he does for Sarah Jane. Go back and watch Seeds of Doom. And it's a flippant thing. They're you know, they're dragged in front of the baddie by at gunpoint, and you know as Tom Baker is constantly being done, you know, gets thrust into a room by some thuggy, and says, oh, you know, have you met Miss Smith? You know, she's my best friend, and it's done as a sort of an offhand comment. But speaking in terms of the history of the show, no one else has earned that accolade,
right?
So, and it's absolutely genuine, both with what she established, with how she dealt with Pertwee. As this sort of this meddling journalist who gets herself into the thick of things, starts out as the damsel in distress kind of character, and then establishes herself within the next few episodes as being strongly feminist and extremely capable. You know, some character makes an offhand comment about the fact that she's the one responsible for bringing the Doctor his coffee, and she says, "Well, I'm fairly certain that he's going to be the one bringing me coffee before long."
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the kind of the way she was and continued to be all the way up through, the kind of admiration and respect that she earned from Tennant in School Reunion.
Right. Yeah. And that's, that's the thing is we've got that, the fact that she comes back and still, after all those years, has that special place in his heart, where you can see, his face just absolutely lights up. And, you might say that was Tennant and his fanboyism, but I think that that's actually an accurate portrayal of the Doctor's reaction to seeing her after so long.
Yeah.
It's here's the one that, no matter how many companions he gets and however many people he runs around with, this is the one that's always going to stick there and say, that's his template almost of, what his companions should be.
Mm-hmm. There were some arguments out there as to whether or not there was an underlying romantic interest, and there were even some things written into some of the dialogue, particularly in a lot of the novelizations and things like that, that suggested that the Sarah Jane had always pined for the Doctor slightly. But the way I sort of took away from it, because paraphrasing a bit, a lot of the things were, when she would be asked by other characters about, especially if you get into the Sarah Jane Adventures and the episode, The Wedding of Sarah Jane Smith, where she's preparing for these things and she gets into a conversation about past loves. Mm. And she said, well, there was this one man, he was larger than life. And I always sort of held a lot of other people, to that regard. But it wasn't necessarily referring to things on a religious, a romantic aspect. Religious, well, there's a slip for you. But it was a matter of, he was, as she states, larger than life. That sort of a thing has an impact on you and it sort of casts a tone over the way that you hold a lot of people in esteem. When you're around somebody who is absolutely that much in command of everything, and then everything else from that point, if you're trying to find somebody who really impresses you and holds your interest, well, you've got some big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
So, but when I look through that, you're bringing ourselves into the Tom Baker years and the fact that you're dealing with a Doctor who is very affable. We've mm-hmm. gotten through the sort of the spikiness that was Hartnell. You got through some of the relationships with Second Doctor, which we'll get to in more detail momentarily. But as far as just the running buddies and the chums and sort of things, and you get through Pertwee, who had those sort of things, but he was more of a business professional sort. Now we get to Baker, where it's smiles and winks and tips of the nose and things. And you've got Beyond Sarah Jane, we start dealing with both of our instances of Romana. Probably yes. More so Romana 2,
yeah.
Because of the fact that Romana 1 was a bit of a bitch. And rightfully so, damn it. But after her regeneration, she sort of softened a bit to some of the Doctor's eccentricities, never gave into them,
mm-hmm.
but she accepted them. And
right.
She was actually an excellent counterpoint to them, which, by the time you get to, things like, emulating his costume.
Yeah.
She wore like a pink outfit and white scarf that if it was just a little bit longer would have been just a sort of a slightly feminized version of his long coat and scarf. But take some of the dialogue that's done back and forth when they get into some of their good scientific discussions or their logical discussions about things like City of Death and some of the other ones that are freely available for you to go out and take a look at. And she's toe for toe
right.
with him.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing is this is the first time that we have seen the Doctor running around with someone who is his equal, that mm-hmm. can keep up with his intellectual speed. Every other time that we've come across someone before now, it's been, the Doctor explaining things to them and kind of dragging them along and saying, no, trust me, I can make this work. Here we have someone that's actually, able to call him out and be like, no, that's not going to work. We need to do this and explain the reasons why and actually convince the Doctor,
And we don't know. I mean, to this day, there's a nice you want to get some longstanding Whovians all in a kerfuffle. Start asking them, where is Romana now? Because after the whole discussion of her going on to become the president of Gallifrey and slipping into, pocket universes and those things, and it goes on and on and on, the alternate realities, that she, we started to get a lot of backstory on her that says that not only was she the doctor's equal, but she may have been actually far above him as far as class, as far as intellect, as far as her political and class standings and things. Because I believe at one estimation, she was a couple hundred years older than him. You know, because you take physical form means absolutely nothing from what we had seen. And especially on their first meeting, I mean, she treated him with so much disdain because he was this rogue element that as far as in the eyes of the remnants of Gallifrey was not only not to be trusted, but to be outright despised for what he had decided to do, you know, and to defy the Gallifreyan High Council and everything that they stood for. You know, she was a bit of a fundamentalist in that regard. Mm-hmm. So the fact that she came around to become, you know, a relatively revered companion, although kind of short-lived, you actually get a lot more of her her connection with the doctor when she's not speaking directly to him. She had these kind of long conversations of all people. She had long conversations with Canine. And you'd get more out of the conversations with Canine to know where her mindset was and the way she was reacting to the way the doctor was treating or speaking with her than you would out of their immediate exchanges, which was kind of an interesting writing perspective there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we jump over a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because I know a lot when we were discussing last time around, we were talking about roles of the companion, and we got through sort of the doctor's classroom of Fifth, where he's got a a whole bevy of people stuffed inside the TARDIS and limbs all over the place. Sixth Doctor dealing with Perry and Mel and forth.
Yeah, he never had anyone that he would call a friend. Nobody could match the love that he had for himself, so he knows.
Precisely, yes. So the Doctor's best friend during the Sixth incarnation was the Doctor.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, I'm going back and I'm doing a re-listen, so to speak, to a lot of Baker's Big Finish episodes and a lot of the novelizations from things. I think I'm in the middle of Attack of the Cybermen right now, which was kind of cute. I came across a collection that had been done of short stories called Short Trips. And More Short Trips was the follow-up collection. And these were, you know, no more than like these little novellas, you know, of about anywhere from 30 to 60 pages or so. When they decided to do the audiobooks to some of these, they actually gave one which was titled Vigil, which I think Eric Seward wrote. They let Nicola Bryant, who obviously, as we know, is Perry, went into the Big Finish production studios and did a lot of the audio play, not audio book readings, but the audio plays with Baker. And you get there, you know, it's kind of nice to hear their voices together again and so forth. Mm-hmm. But this one was entirely read by her, and her reading as Baker.
Oh, jeez.
Was classic. Oh, because gosh. She puts on a big voice, and she's all, and you can tell it's like she's leaning into the microphone and probably cords are standing out on her neck when she's trying to read Baker's voice. I digress, but it's worth picking up if you get an opportunity. You know, thumb through the Big Finish archives there and grab hold of it if you can. Vigil was the name of the one in particular that's standing out in my head. It's only like 20 minutes long in audiobook recording, but it's classic. The other side of it is as I'm listening to Attack of the Cybermen now, he's reading as Perry and doing an American accent equally.
Oh.
Absolute gold.
Yeah, I'm going to have to find those. That sounds brilliant.
But as I said, so if we're jumping ahead a little bit, because if we want to say that the relationships, most of the relationships that Davidson had were sort of the mentor role, you might say the same for the Sixth to a certain degree, although it was like the angry professor. And then Seventh, you know, we're going to discuss that shortly too, but to a great degree, that was kind of a mentor role between Ace and her professor. Mm-hmm. Eighth was, I don't know, what do you want to call that relationship?
Yeah, that was Eighth Doctor. Yeah.
Stunted. We didn't get enough of an opportunity to establish that. So then we get up into Ninth. And we have an opportunity to have a look at a couple of other potential true, label them friend or compatriot as opposed to necessarily companion relationships. Mm-hmm. And we come across Captain Jack.
Again, you know, we've got a character that you know, the Doctor can't stand in first passing, you know, absolutely loathes. And, you know, the first bit that we get about him, you know, is just the Doctor completely berating him and telling Rose how, you know, how horrible he is and this, that, and the other. And then, you know, you see the relationship grow. Mm-hmm. And it finally gets to a point where they, you know, we don't get the depth that you get from some of the other companions and stuff. But again, I mean, it's that, you know, you do get the sense that they really are truly friends.
Yeah. Well, I got to wonder, when you mention the fact that there's this sort of the disdain that Jack is treated with at the outset, granted, he is not exactly the easiest character to look past some of his foibles. But do you think that some of that, at least the initial reaction that he gets from Ninth in things like Dr. Dance's Empty Child and those things, mm-hmm. are because of the Doctor's disdain for time agents at that institution?
I think so. I think that's his initial knee-jerk reaction, because, I mean, that's what we got with the Ninth Doctor a lot, was all of these things had been built into him. You know, he's coming off of the Time War where, you know, he acted as a soldier, and things are reflex, and you act. You don't think, you don't ponder through, you act, and you get things done. So we see him, you know, fighting through all of the programming. And I think that's what it is he sees someone and his initial reaction is just, oh, time agents, they all suck. So he, you know, starts bashing Jack, and, you know, over time begins to, okay, you know, things calm down and he's able to actually think it through. And you've got Rose that's, you know, going to bat for him and everything. And you get to see Jack's own reactions when he realizes what he's done and things like that. And you can tell that he's not just some dick con artist that doesn't want, you know, that takes no responsibility or anything like that. You can start to see his character, and the Doctor begins to see it too and think, okay, it's not all horrible, but it's just that knee-jerk reaction that we get from the Ninth Doctor a lot.
Right, yeah. And I don't think in a lot of regard, as far as Jack's past and how he came to work for the agency and that sort of thing, as these things become clearer to us as the viewers, and we start to understand a little bit more of his backstory, especially when you come down to the point where, by the time we get to Last of the Time Lords, mm-hmm. and we start to find out, you know, as a result of, you know, we get his childhood backstory,
yeah,
and the fact that he was this resident of this territory known as the Beauchene
Peninsula.
And he becomes the poster boy for the time agency, and then later becomes known as the face of Bo. Hello. And everything suddenly comes full circle, because we've already established this wonderful sort of deep esteem and respect that the Doctor has for the face of Bo. Mm-hmm. Then that totally locks it in and says that, okay, from the earliest inceptions, it might have been spiky, it might have been tenuous, but over their centuries of running about together and running past one another and leaping into it as needed for one another, and it probably was for one another in many instances.
Yeah,
you know, both the Doctor stumbling into instances where Jack is well up to his neck in things and he has to leap into it, or cases like we've seen through the nature of the program. So the Doctor was in need of it, and Jack comes in, you know, teeth shining and guns blazing. That's sort of a friendship has been established.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when we find out that, you know, he was called the face of Bo, that, you know, when he reveals that, I think that the look on Tennant's face in that scene just is perfect for that, because, you know, at that moment the Doctor realizes the full scope of everything that they've been through together. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Jack and the face of Bo, apparently, you know, assuming this is all canon, please stop the hate mail. You know, it's
we didn't write it, folks. Come on, it's in the script.
Yeah, but you know, it's assuming that that is all well and good. You know, Jack would understand chronologically how it's going. You know, once he becomes the face of Bo, he has that depth of relationship to build on, and that's why we see him reach out to the Doctor and instantly embrace him and, you know, help him out and things like that. You know, metaphorically embrace, of course. But the Doctor doesn't understand that. He just thought that the hero is this benevolent being that was, you know, millions of years old or whatever, and you know, he kind of accepted it, and then he realizes this was all built on what we have just accomplished. You know, this was all something, you know, that goes into it. and you see in his face at that moment the depth of what that friendship really is. So yeah. I think it's just it's a great portrayal, and it's, you know, if you want to assume, you know, if your headcanon says that, you know, they're two separate characters, fine, but it just adds so much more depth to that relationship if you accept the way that it was written.
Right. And if you need other instances to sort of back up the continuing adventures between them, there's a lot of novel content to do so. Mm. A couple of which are the trio of the Doctor, Rose, and Jack traveling about. The only one that I've personally read, I know there's a couple, there's titles in mind, like The Deviant Strain. I read, I want to say 75% of one called Only Human, which was actually, you know, pretty interesting, but I kind of walked away from it because it involved dealing with Neanderthals, and it was reminiscent to me of like, you know, First Doctor stuff, you know, dealing with cavemen. But there are a lot of others out there where it is literally just Jack and the Doctor banging about, like Stealers of Dreams and a couple of others. And I'll try to put links out there so that you can find those. They're still in print, and you can still get your hands on a good number of them on Amazon, both in the US and the UK. But that brings me around to Rose, specifically Ninth and Rose.
What?
Well, before they got all ooji-boo, you know.
Right.
And as far as just the sheer, and this is a point where you get into one of those friend relationships where it's like you call somebody up at, you know, you're thinking, you know, it's your senior year of high school or your freshman year of college, and you call up the good friend of yours who you've had for who knows how many years, who you've known since second grade or what have you, and you call them up on a Saturday morning at 9 o'clock and wake them, of course, because you're calling them yeah. at 9 o'clock, and say, you know, put some socks on, I'm coming around my dad's car, we're going to the amusement park, and you're going to go have a wild adventure for the day, completely unplanned. That's the sort of the camaraderie and the sort of the just wing yourself out there relationship that I thought exemplified a lot of Ninth and Rose for me personally.
See, I would almost say that description that you put out there is more what we get with Clara, because, you know, Rose, just as soon as the Doctor said, you know, come with me, you know, or you know, when he said, you know, it travels in time, and then she just went, and there was no, you know, I mean, I guess, yeah, I can see where you're coming from with that, but it just seems more like I'm fascinated with this character. You know, it's like we were talking about before with being enamored with the Doctor. And I mean, I do think that they grew, obviously they grew a very strong friendship, which later became more, but you know, there was that friendship. I just don't think that was the basis initially. I feel like the first thing was Rose just, you know, having all of these incredible things, stopping and taking a look at her life and being like, this is not what I want. You know, I don't want any of this stuff. This guy's offering me escape. I'm going to go with it.
Right. Well, maybe that's because I know later, as we start to get into Rose's relationship with Tenth, then the aspect of Rose's family really starts to come more and more into play. Not necessarily all through Jackie's involvement, but just sort of the idea that in the, we know that Rose comes from a family dynamic that, while a little, I don't even know what adjective to apply to these things, just in terms of her relationship with her mother, it's relatively tight. You know, it's the, you know, check in with me when you can sort of a thing. And right. Jackie actually is a very caring mother and so forth, you know, for what she is. But as the relationship between Rose and the Doctor, as far as being comfortable with one another, going off onto these wild and potentially dangerous adventures together, I think that as more and more of those are notched off, they develop a sort of an understanding for one another where there's a lot of it is expressed through nonverbal cues. You know, they get into situations dealing with confrontations, and I'm thinking well beyond the first half dozen episodes, when they really start to get comfortable with some of the scenarios that they have to face, that there's a strength that they take in knowing each other well enough at that point that they can face things mm-hmm. that they don't even need to be expressed. I'll give you some examples momentarily, but it's just I just feel that by the time we get towards the end of Eccleston's season, they have a rhythm that mm-hmm. is one that you expect close friends to have, you know, the nearly completing each other's sentences sort of things, or right. just being on the same wavelength as they get into the thick of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one scene that I kind of think about, and it's a very pivotal scene for me. It's one of those that I've always thought was one of my favorites, is the scene in Dalek when, you know, the doctor's getting ready to shoot the Dalek and Rose stops him and says, you know, no, this is not going to happen. You know, that moment, it just kind of exemplifies that for me when, you know, she has enough trust in the doctor to be able to stand in front of him while he's pointing a gun at her and know mm-hmm. that he's not going to pull the trigger. And the fact that the doctor knows and trusts Rose enough to listen to her when he's staring at the very last Dalek, you know, yeah. the fact that he's willing to, you know, stop and listen to what she has to say to him instead of destroying this enemy that he just sacrificed his planet for, you know, it's one of those moments that just kind of makes you stop and think that there's a lot to this relationship.
Right. There are a number of instances that you can point at, particularly within the last, you know, 8 years or so, that point out the human companion that brings to the doctor's realization something that he has lost sight of along the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a trope that we come back to regularly.
Right.
Rose sold that with conviction because of the fact that she could command his attention in the midst of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think there's something to be said for someone who can, you know, while the world is crashing down around you, someone that can grab you by the shoulders and say, listen, you know, without screaming, without having to slap you across the face, which Clara does to 11th all the time, you know, that sort of thing. That's their bit to snap him out of it. Rose didn't need to do that. You know, she could do so with a word. She could do so with a look, because they paid attention to one another
mm-hmm.
when they were really riffing well together. So that's sort of a, you know, it wasn't necessary to take it any farther than that point. So, and I think that's one of the reasons why, as we start to get into the relationship between Tenth and Rose, even before it started to take on its romantic undertones, that, you know, even take some of the examples we most recently have been talking about. You know, I picture the two of them joking about in the Idiot's Lantern within the first 10 minutes as they're hopping off the scooter together mm-hmm. and, you know, and dropping daddy-o references to one another. And they're just loving the situation that they're in, even though they screwed up and they landed at the wrong time. They realize it's coronation weekend. They're going to make the best of that. It's that weekend at the amusement park,
right?
Kind of approach.
Yeah, it's the, you know, well, we didn't wind up where we wanted to be, but I'm with my best friend, so, you know, mm-hmm. we can find fun to have. And yeah, you really do get that in some of those earlier episodes, where you can tell that, you know, the fact that they're in London instead of New York just does not matter at all. They don't care because, you know, they're there together.
Yeah. Original plans fell through, but I'm with my mate. We've got this time. We'll make the best of it. We'll have a great time. You know, we'll have a laugh.
Yeah.
Now take that and put that running buddy kind of a relationship with someone who's not quite as soft or I don't even know what kind of a comparative adjective I can use here. Someone who's not Donna, and then compare that with someone who is Donna once they really start to hit their groove. Because at least initially, if you take Runaway Bride and that sort of thing, and the disdain that she carries for him, from that point on, anything that she throws back at him, you can tell is one of those kind of relationships where, you know, it's a buddy relationship where only you can call your best friend, you know, the most horrible names under the sun, but right. do so with a smirk, and it's all understood.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing, is when you look at their relationship starting in The Runaway Bride, I mean, Donna was built as a character that you were not supposed to really like. She was, you know, she was spiky, she was obnoxious, she was brash and boorish, and she was just everything made just to rub you the wrong way. Yeah. So you've got the doctor just thrown in with her. You know, here's someone he wouldn't even think twice about talking to, really. Yeah. And she's forced on him. Mm-hmm. And as they go through their adventure, you know, he gets her off safely. He, you know, they save the world together, whatever. And then she goes about her business and he's like, you know what? She wasn't as bad as I thought she was at the beginning. And then we run into her again in Partners in Crime, and you can see his face just kind of like, really? Like, again? And it you can tell even in that episode that they start to have fun together. It's that, you know, like you mentioned before, it's the old friend from high school that you haven't seen in ages, and then you bump into again, and it's like it's been a weekend. You know, you've got that camaraderie that just comes back naturally, and now Donna has, you know, has changed drastically, so she's not nearly as obnoxious. You know, so you really can have that interplay between them.
Mm-hmm. I think it plays out really well. I mean, if you want to see the kind of the if you want to get some sort of an assurance that they have reached a level of friendship that is one that you can kind of, you know, draw a parallel. Take a look at episodes like the Centauran Stratagem, the Poison Sky, where she's dealing with a lot of family issues. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you now have a backdrop that says, okay, as Donna, or turn left for that matter, you know, mm-hmm. In that example as well. So you're dealing with instances where the doctor is dealing with the risk of harm to her family, you know, and her grandfather's at risk because of the Atmos gas and, mm-hmm. and so forth. Her relationship at that point with the doctor, by contrast, is very much one of those I've got to lock arms with my mate. The two of us are going to handle this together because I've got someone in my corner. That's then the doctor leaping in to be, as much as he was sort of doing the save the day routine, a lot of this was very personal, specifically for Donna, because she was the immediate connection to the atrocities that were going on.
Right.
So that's one in particular that kind of stands out in my head. I mean, aside from just some of the great exchanges they had in the fires of Pompeii, mm-hmm. you know, where it gets down to now you've got friends at odds with one another. You really want to see where a friendship stands? Put them into an argument,
right,
and see where those things shake out, because that's a real test of the metal between those two when they have that kind of a moral dilemma, or not even dilemma, mm-hmm. but a moral disparity conflict between the two,
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, and that's the thing that kind of gets me, though, is like thinking about it, and you know, with everyone that we've mentioned before, there's always been something that the doctor, you know, almost needed from the other person, and that's what they built their friendship on. You know, with the Brigadier, he needed that person he could rely on that was, you know, that had their own life, but he knew that he could count on. With, you know, with Sarah Jane, it was the same kind of thing, but it was, you know, the fact that she was with him. You know, Romana, it was the intellectual similarity that he needed, somebody like a sounding board and, you know, someone to brainstorm with. You know, so everyone has had something that the doctor needed, but with Donna, we didn't really get that. You know, it wasn't like, oh, well, she's, you know, the best TARDIS pilot that ever existed, so, you know, having her along makes sense. No, but the thing is like, it was built up the whole season, or the whole series was built up saying there's something special about this woman. Mm-hmm. You know, and the doctor can't figure it out, and he's sticking with her because he knows that there's a reason for it. Right. And, you know, we've all had that friend that, you know, no matter how many times they messed up, no matter what situation they got you into, anything like that, you stuck with them because there was just something important about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I think the doctor feels towards Donna, is like, you know, she's not really bringing anything to the party. She's just, you know, she's just a good friend. And he, for some reason, that is important to keep around for him at that point.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned specifically the idea of companions in that regard. I want to say there's a reason why, as I was starting to itemize these and I was sort of taking these through chronological order, we said, oh, okay, well, you know, he's been such close friends with the Pons. Well, we're not going to discuss the Pons and with regards to their friendship relationship, because we're going to get to that in a different scope in just a second. But for a split second, I thought about saying, well, why aren't we going to put Clara into this camp, you know, bringing this up to present moment? Mm-hmm. Only reason why I would say so is because I personally, and I haven't really, I know we've sort of tangentially discussed this, but I haven't really gone into a lot of detail with you on this, Shay. was the way I particularly see the relationship between 11th and Clara. And I've got a feeling that you're kind of, you know, in step with this, but this is something where it falls more into the family camp than the friend camp for me personally. But I know Jenna Coleman I want to say maybe about 4 months back was interviewed, or right around the time the Capaldi reveal was all happening. Mm-hmm. And they asked her, or this is right before the reveal, I believe. And they said, well, what are you foreseeing from the next Doctor, whoever that's going to be, whoever's going to be stepping out of the TARDIS next to, you know, who is that going to be to Clara in this instance? And she said, you know, in her opinion, that I would like to see the next Doctor to be the best friend mm-hmm. to Clara. Which sort of says to me that she didn't believe that that's what they currently had.
Right.
Because it's something different. And I want to get to that momentarily. But I figured I'd throw that out there because that's a direct kind of addressing of the relationship that they've had to date.
Right. Yeah, I could definitely agree with that. You know, there's a lot more to Clara's character than just, you know, friendship. Because, yeah, it's a lot deeper than that. The way that Moffat has written it has been, you know, something much, much stronger, much more, a lot more depth that he's tried to pour into it. So, so there's also companions that we've run into, well, that aren't actually companions. We've had the one-off companions that we've bumped into, but the one that I always tend to think of that really... You know, you can say, yes, that is a friend of the Doctor. And we see it play out that way throughout, you know, the subsequent series. Mm-hmm. But it would be Craig from The Lodger.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the kind of the chum or the mate that, as far as the Doctor is concerned, and again, we're sort of looking at this from the Doctor's perspective. There's a number of individuals who may consider the Doctor to be a friend, but we're sort of looking at it from the inverse. These are individuals where the Doctor jumps into it and lends somebody a hand. You know, who would the Doctor be likely to go help them, you know, pull a couch up a flight of stairs, you know, when they move apartments and that sort of thing? And Craig definitely falls into that camp by all means, you know, sort of helping him not only with his, you know, his sort of social ineptitude, you know, granted he sort of takes over the football team and that sort of thing. But as far as like the, you know, take baby advice, you know, all through closing time and that sort of thing. You know, that's the sort of thing that you do. You jump out there and you lend a hand, even if you have no idea what your advice is. You try to be there just as a support group.
Yeah, and that we see that when he's going and saying goodbye to everyone, when he's like, you know, I'm going to die. It's, you know, this is the end of it. Whatever. You know, he makes a point to stop and see Craig. You know, he wanted to say goodbye to Craig. And I mean, that right there, just, I mean, that's perfect example of why they're, you know, he's considered a friend. You mm-hmm. know, he's going and saying goodbye to everyone that he needs to. And Craig is one of the first people he stops off at.
Yeah. I think I'm really surprised maybe it was because they were sort of keeping closing time to be a sort of a light episode. They were really going for some of the warmth factor in that, despite the fact that it was a Cybermen episode that actually showed somebody getting sealed into the suit and whatnot. But because of the whole aspect of it, closing time and that exchange, think about where we were chronologically. We were dealing with the fact that we were in the midst of the Impossible Astronaut series. The Doctor's doing his farewell tour, you know, by his own admission.
Yeah.
You know, and that could have been a very kind of heavy moment. But think about it, that if you were cognizant of the fact that you had a limited time left, who would you go back and check in with just to say, I just want to spend 5-10 minutes to chat with you, and, you know, and sort of leave things on good standing before I shuffle off?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that says quite a bit. Granted, of course, in classic, you know, Whovian fashion, you know, it becomes a, you know, an adventure dealing with something otherworldly, but maybe that wasn't really the intent. You know, you got to wonder, did he really have any idea what was going to be happening when he showed up on the Owens threshold that day? Yeah. You know, Or did he? I don't know. I don't really want to undermine. I'd rather take the Ujibu approach and think that he was doing it with all the best intentions.
Yeah, that's. I really do think that that is how it went. You know, he wanted to be able to go and say goodbye to him. But yeah, it's such a great friendship because it's not, you know, the Craig never really took anything from the Doctor. He wasn't like, oh, I want to go traveling with you. Take me with you. He was just, they, you know, cohabitated for a while and they just meshed. You know, now granted, you know, the Doctor did do his Vulcan mind meld thing on him, and you know, his IQ shot up about like 4,000 points. But yeah, it was just a great thing of like seeing the Doctor fit in with, you know, a normal person. We always love seeing that because that normal person could very easily be us. You know, and that's what makes it so great seeing these episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yep, by all means.
Okay, but we're getting a little bit long-winded here, so we're going to go ahead and break this conversation up right now. We'll talk about the family aspect next week, but for right now, let's go ahead and jump into some news.
Yeah, and some interesting stuff this time around. Oh, well, not this, not always interesting, but I'm kind of intrigued by a lot of the headlines that have come around. Some of it is interesting, and some of it is just stuff that I had to roll my eyes at.
So let's talk about the big one. Let's talk about the introduction of a new character.
Okay. So I'm gonna say one thing, and then I'm gonna let you steer the rest of this.
All right.
This is a new recurring character.
Yeah.
This is not as of necessarily yet. As far as we know, from the officials who write this crap, this is not a new companion. Okay, yeah. I'm done.
Yeah. So, Samuel Anderson, who has been in The History of Boys, Gavin and Stacey, Emmerdale, is set to be joining the cast of Doctor Who. He is going to be playing, as you said, the recurring character of Danny Pink, who is a teacher at Coal Hill School along with Clara. So this could just be the friend that we run into every now and again, just as a touchstone to modern day London. You know, we've seen it done plenty of times before without the person becoming a companion. So stop with all the hate. We don't know yet. You know, this is all fairly new. So let's let this play out before we, you know, actually string somebody up.
It's going to be an interesting character. I love the fact that they're introducing another teacher to the Coal Hill School, you know, and bringing that whole thing full circle again. I mean, I loved it when they mentioned it in the 50th and the fact that she was teaching there. I thought, this is such a perfect tip of the hat.
And the fact that, that on the sign, at least, it says that Ian Chesterton is the current headmaster. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's fantastic. I would love to do is have Clara and the Doctor come back at some point because Danny called them and said, look, you need to get back here. There's something going on. So they come in and they see, you know, they interact with them. And all of a sudden, in walks Clara's boss, Ian Chesterton, headmaster of the school, walks in, comes face to face with the Doctor and says something along the lines of, you look awfully familiar. And then we go about the scene. Like, just bring William Russell back just for a couple minutes as a cameo. That would be brilliant. And with the introduction of this character, we can have that kind of thing play in without it being obvious fan wank, which, I mean, that's obvious what it would be, but still.
Yeah. So the question becomes, and everybody's all in a tizzy about it, is whether or not he's going to slip into the idea of a male companion role. Then people jump into the fray and say, well, this is just pandering to public outcry. And then the public outcry comes back and says, well, what's wrong with it? You know, what's wrong with having a male companion there? And then the whole Moffat is sexist discussion gets all ramped up again, and it just gets uglier and uglier and uglier.
Yeah. Well, there's,
let's just say Danny Pink's going to be an interesting character. And he's going to be involved with dealing with Daleks because they were on set the day that they were prepping him for his costumes.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm excited. The fact that they're bringing somebody else in is very exciting news. And I can't wait to see how it gets played out. So,
yeah,
good stuff. So what else do we got on the list here?
Well, backtracking a little bit, I know, speaking as I do occasionally of what they might refer to as the Omni rumor, about whether or not some of the lost episodes are ever going to come back about again. There were some stories over the last 6 months about some archives that might have been tracked down within a Nigerian television relay station that were relatively well preserved, and they were handed over to the BBC archivist to see whether there was any material in there that could be used to remaster or salvage existing material. And it was not just Doctor Who; it was a lot of film capture. But there have been some grumblings as to whether or not we may see Marco Polo as the next lost episode to be restored and released in addition to what we've recently been handed as far as Pertwee episode, or I'm sorry, Troughton episodes, which are the ones where we have one of the greatest gaps,
right,
as far as lost material.
Well, Marco Polo was Hartnell, wasn't it?
Well, yes, okay. But I mean, as far as there is the discussion right now that we are dealing with potentially four episodes. We're going to share, obviously, the linked up is going to share some of the discussion about what's been coming back up here. There are four serials, I should say. I got to use my terminology carefully. Four serials involved with a total of 14 episodes throughout, because a couple of these are shorter sequences. Of which they believe if there's going to be any that you can get back in full restored nature, as far as getting the entirety of it, Marco Polo being one of Hartnell's episodes would be the first one to see it in entirety. The gaps, as far as my point with Troughton being, if you were to look at the lost episodes that are out there, the majority of them happen to fall within the Second Doctor period, where we only have the audio remaining because of the fact that BBC was keeping, again, we've discussed this many times, BBC keeping their archives the way they did. They had a lot of lost material as far as the original physical format before they had it in any sort of a more permanent archive. This does mean that between the what they're going to refer to as the Nigerian rumor, what they will refer to as the South Korean rumor, because there was a military relay station that they believed had some original film as well, that they don't really know why they had it, but it was kicking around. And there was another as well. I'll have to trace back the origins on it. But they had a gentleman who is officially the sort of the voice of the BBC archives, who has waffled back and forth to the point where he sounds like a meteorologist in the way that he changes his story from moment to moment about there's absolutely nothing new under the sun to be found except this. But beyond this, there's absolutely nothing except this.
Yeah.
And they would have to keep kind of backtracking on it, because honestly, it's a matter of, I think it's because of the fact that the program has been getting a greater and greater global recognition that individuals in these remote locations that would have had no reason to even delve through these dusty piles of film tins that they had have come across something that says, you know, oh, hold on a tick, that actually looks like it could be some of this Doctor Who material that people have been talking about. And get that turned in. And now, thankfully, because of the interconnectedness of the internet outreach and the popularity of the program in as many dozens and dozens of languages and national broadcasts, international broadcasting formats that it's been, that I honestly think that we're going to at least see a few more over the course of the next 3 to 4 years. I'd like to see at least a few more episodes in their entirety. Restored and released. And I firmly believe that the BBC is sitting on at least two of those right now and is going through the process of getting them remastered before they can hand them over. Personal opinion entirely. Beat me up at will.
I'd like to see all of them restored, but you know, that's...
Yeah, no, I'm willing to say that I think a few of them are genuinely permanently lost. It's just, right. It's bound to happen because of the nature of the way that the physical format of the celluloid broke down. And we've got the audio, and that's great. You can go ahead and recreate it in your mind if you choose to. But the film for some of these is honestly, I don't know that we were necessarily with any kind of forethought archiving those things anywhere around the world with any assuredness to see them revived. But how many episodes currently still on the lost list? I mean, we've got to be able to pull a few more out of there by looking through some of these rare finds, as have been recently discussed. So
yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, speaking of rumors,
yeah. So
let's take this dumb one from
the mirror. We love to poke fun at them, but oh my, there comes a point when stupidity becomes just sad. Apparently, they are trying to say that. That Series 8 could be Peter Capaldi's one and only series. They're saying that he's going to be a transitional doctor, much like the Ninth Doctor was. And everything in this article is just complete and utter tripe. I mean,
yeah.
It makes no sense at all.
This is what happens on slow news weeks.
Mm-hmm.
This was published between the discussion of the costume and before the announcement of a new recurring character. So you've got all these self-proclaimed know-it-alls who are trying to find something to discuss now, and the bloggers run amok, and you get somebody out there who says, well, what if he's only in there for one season? What if we're starting to set a precedent based on what Tom Baker said in the 50th anniversary about going back and revisiting old favorites, and now you're going to have one doctor per season, and it's just going to be a revolving door.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? What if you're just trying to find something to fill so that you can meet your writing quota for the week? I mean, some of the things that were pulled, and we're definitely going to link this one in here, because feel free to jump all over Richard Beach for everything that he's got to say. Yes, that's Richard Beach of The Mirror. Reachable at themirror.co.uk/Richard-Beach/. Because it's honestly just muckraking, as far as I'm concerned.
It's nerd baiting at this point. You know, he's trying to write something spectacular so that people click on the link and be like, "What is the information that you have?" He's just trying to farm the links, farm the clicks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just no.
Yeah. And you know, when you start to get to something where reliable sources have said.
They're reliable. Just trust me on this. I'm not going to name them, but they're reliable.
My gran says he won't be here next year.
What? Yeah.
So take that for what it's worth. We thought we would mention it though, because it's one of those things that just kind of says, as you see in news formats right and left, if you don't have another story to report on, make up a story. So yeah. Tail wagging the dog.
Well, yeah. But then we did get Peter Capaldi making an appearance in his costume.
Yeah.
This was kind of cool. He showed up at the BBC Worldwide Showcase event. And, he's speaking to Graham Norton, just sitting out there in his costume. And, I mean, it looks awesome on him, too. Like, now that we're seeing it actually, like, seeing him move around and stuff like that, instead of just the one promo shot that we've got, it looks pretty sweet. And it looks a lot less like a costume than a lot of the previous stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this carries as just a well suited suit, you know.
Yeah.
For him, he seems very comfortable with it. No additional information conveyed. This really isn't, you know, any sort of groundbreaking stuff. It's just him making kind of the appearances there and saying how excited he is about being a part of everything that's going to be coming up in the fall, and just basically, you know, getting everybody to kind of foam at the mouth again, but, you know, really comfortable with it. Looking ready to go. I hate to gush, but I'm gushing because I really think that we're in for a really welcome change in terms of kind of turning around what the show can accomplish and some of the areas that we can explore that is still our program that we're still so enthralled with, but is willing to take some risks. And I know that some Moffat haters believe that he's very formulaic and refuses to take risks because, just like, you know, he doesn't want to kill off characters permanently, he's afraid of sweeping changes. Mm-hmm. But again, if you rely on your talent and you write to your cast, just as we talked about the other week about, you know, some of the writing for Smith really became writing for Smith.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, the vice versa, Smith stepping into a script and saying, okay, I can do this. If we're writing for Capaldi, then we could definitely have a very, very different experience ahead of us for at least the next season, before he gets replaced going into season.
Yes, yeah, because that's in danger. So, and then the last little bit of non-news that we got is there was a post recently, and it was actually from a week or so ago, that it was just a stipulation or a question of, like, if Doctor Who had been made by Americans or had been an American show.
And, from the inception.
Yeah. And it's just a list of actors, of American actors, that, you know, that they cast as the doctors and stuff. And I mean, these are some of these you laugh at, but some of these are actually really, really good suggestions.
And you're going to be able to tell immediately where my heart lies on this as you walk through the list. But let's kind of stroll through this for a second here. So if we were to take it from the beginning, and you take your sort of your curmudgeon, we're dealing with Burgess Meredith, which, you know, I like the fact that a lot of this is almost sort of period accurate.
Yeah.
As far as where they chose each person to step into the role. So you got Burgess Meredith in the mid 60s. So I'm picturing him just kind of berating someone as if he were yelling at Rocky. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be funny.
But then we get to the second Doctor, where we've always equated that with Troughton as being this sort of the unpredictable, the kind-hearted, but is he really safe at any given moment? And you drop in Dick Van Dyke.
Right. And I mean, this makes a lot of sense. If you look at the time period where he was in popularity and the kind of character that they went with, you know, Patrick Troughton was known as a comedic actor. He, you know, had a lot of skills and stuff. Dick Van Dyke fits that mold, especially in this time period. So it would have been a good fit, I think. Mm-hmm. So then we go on to the third Doctor, and we get Vincent Price.
Early 70s. Price was at his peak. He was doing some of the creepiest films you could possibly get your hands on. And he was, while he was a strong dramatic actor, he could also obviously play the kind of the horror aspect of it as well. As a third Doctor, as a down to business, you know, you're sort of your scientist, necessarily mad scientist role. I don't know, but Vincent Price would have been amazing.
Yeah,
and then
the fourth Doctor.
this is I couldn't have pegged this better if I tried. Gene Wilder.
Yes. I mean, equivalent of Tom Baker.
Yeah. Well, Willy Wonka steps out of the TARDIS. Hello? What? So you couldn't have gone any better. That at that point, as I was scrolling through these, said, all right, you've got me one. I'll take that.
Yeah. So, and then we get the fifth Doctor. We get Kyle MacLachlan.
Yeah, and I like that because of the fact that he had that kind of he was the dashing male character, but he was the type that you felt that you could put some trust into. But then again, by the same token, was just one of those ones where he couldn't possibly be seen as threatening because he just had that baby face.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, he definitely could have pulled off Davison's portrayal. Then we go into the sixth Doctor.
I don't know. Perry, maybe. Wow. I'm in the TARDIS. I'm a Time Lord. Damn it.
I don't see Christopher Walken being able to pull off some of the insults that Colin Baker could throw around, but oh my God, it would have been hilarious to see.
I would have traded in so many other things to be able to see that.
I'm mainly thinking the Doctor squaring off, you know, during the trial of the Time Lord. Can you picture him in the courtroom?
look, square
Brickyard, which
Valyard, Brickyard, Shipyard. What are you? Maybe. So then we get ourselves into the late 80s. And here's where I start to deviate a bit. Because, all right, you take your Sylvester McCoy. Take the idea of this mad magician kind of character, and they went with Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah.
Tony Shalhoub in late 80s was doing Wings, the sitcom for NBC.
Right.
I can't – this one I'm not quite
Okay, I can get what you're saying, but in retrospect, knowing what Tony Shalhoub has pulled off since then, I don't know. I think he might have been able to pull it off. I mean, granted, at the time, no, I wouldn't have ever thought of that. But knowing since then what he can do, I can give this one a little bit of credence.
Okay.
Just a little bit.
All right. So, if you could do that, can you accept their replacement for the Eighth Doctor when they go with Jeff Goldblum? I can't even... I have a lot of respect for Goldblum. I've seen, you know, far more material on film than I've probably wanted to with Goldblum. I've seen him on stage doing some work that I thought was well outside of his comfort zone, give him a lot of credit for. I don't see this one.
No. Maybe the hair is in this picture.
That's the only thing I could say is he's able to pull off the mop headed dude without it actually being a wig.
But I don't see this one. I think it would be entertaining. I mean, that's the thing with all of these that like I didn't think was a good match. I'd be like, I'd be interested to see it at least. Mm-hmm. I think it could be fun.
Then we get up to our reboot. And this one, I'm going to go with this.
Yeah.
I can roll with this one to hand the angst-ridden Ninth Doctor to Nicolas Cage. For 1 year. That's all you can take.
But you think about it. I mean, in 2005, this is like right in that time zone of National Treasure. You know, when they cast Christopher Eccleston, it was because he was well-known. He was an actor that people knew, but he wasn't, you know, like a Brad Pitt style or, you know, level famous. You know, he was a well enough known name that you could draw people in, but they could still accept him as the Doctor. Nick Cage was in that zone where a lot of people knew him, but he was in so many things that you could accept him in pretty much anything that got put out at the time. This is before he went like, you know, complete nuts and his face wound up on everything. But I don't know. I think that this, I could have seen this happening.
Okay. Yeah. Then we deviate again, because I'm sorry, no, no, and hell no.
Okay, separate yourself for a moment from Tennant. Remove Tennant from your head and think the 10th Doctor, the just the basic core of what the 10th Doctor was, and put Sam Rockwell in there.
No, I can't. It's that joie de vivre, it's that childlike fascination with the adventure, where Rockwell to me says more snark.
Yeah,
he is so snarky. I mean, even in some of the roles where he's been able to play that down a bit, but I mean, there's certain ones where I'm sorry, he's typecast for a reason. And granted, for those of you who have seen like Moon and some of the other dramatic roles that he's done, exceptional.
Yeah,
he won me over on those, but I don't okay. I don't see him having that kind of a, you know, hop on board, we've got, you know, amazing stuff to go see. That to me does not say Rockwell.
It would have been a very different show. I'm giving you that. I'm not saying that it was a complete match, but I could almost see him doing a somewhat reminiscent job. But again, it's one of those where no, it doesn't match up, but I would have loved to have seen him try. I would have loved to have seen what he could have done with the role, you know? So
that one in particular, I'm going to play around in my head with other replacements for that. If that were to happen, okay. I'm trying to think, you know, the late 2000s, who else could really be in there that would kind of exemplify that from a US side of the casting decision, because there's gotta be a couple out there that are banging around in my head that might be better suited.
Right. Okay.
Personally.
So then we get to the 11th Doctor. And we get Donald Glover.
I don't. Well, the 11th Doctor is as we've been discussing, he's the friend and the family member. He's the clown in control.
I think one of the reasons why Matt Smith did so well is because he took. Yeah. All right. When you had Hartnell in the role, he was obviously an old man who was trying to play an old curmudgeon-y man that was really just a rebellious teenager. And it worked. You know, you could get that to some extent. Smith was a younger guy who was trying to play a younger guy, but really he was just an old, tired man.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think that Donald Glover could put that into his performance. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I've really ever seen him in is Community. So trying to put Troy in the TARDIS is a little bit weird, but I don't think that he would be able to nuance his performance enough to really sell that to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But again, I think it'd be fun.
Yeah. That's another one where I'd have to be really hard pressed to find someone who I know could stay light and be able to maintain the Geronimo mm-hmm. aspect
yeah.
of the adventure. But at the same time, when it really comes down to it and you have to play those more poignant moments, can really sell the pathos.
Yeah.
And that's where I definitely deviate from what I know of Donald mm-hmm. Glover.
Right.
Then we start just pot shotting at this point just for popularity's sake and say, oh, well, 12th Doctor, he needs to be kind of gruff and we're not really sure what to expect from him yet. Yeah, give him Bryan Cranston because he surprised the hell out of us. He went from yeah. being Malcolm's dad
to being Walter White.
Yeah, so he's got a stretch. But I don't know necessarily that I personally would kind of draw that parallel, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just the popularity aspect of it right now that he kind of fits what we expect to see from... I don't know. It'd be cool, though. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting.
I do like their choice for the interim war doctor.
Yes.
As far as the one who actually had to deal with all of the atrocities of the Time War and going with Harrison Ford as that grizzled, kind of Kirk curmudgeon.
Yeah.
But that's a nice call, especially with what Ford's been up to lately and the kind of thing that he mm-hmm. represents.
I mean, I could definitely see him doing it. And he'd be a lot more serious, I think, than John Hurt was. Where John Hurt was able to make the jokes and, Dickie Bow and Sand Shoes and whatnot. But I think Harrison Ford would play up the aspect of, I've seen some stuff,
Yeah.
But, it would be great to see, but anyway, but yeah, that's the list of those. And I mean,
maybe again, one of these days we'll do a post on GallifreyPunkRadio.com and say, if you were to do, casting swaps for any one of the doctors, and we'll let people kind of chime in on that. That could be a lot of fun, or it could be potentially scary as hell.
Yeah, true. It could be very scary.
Gender swaps.
Oh, geez. That could be fun. Let us know what you thought about our discussion here. Definitely give us some feedbacks and let us know what we missed, what you think should have been included, or what we were completely off base. Just go ahead and write, completely berate us.
We always respond well to being berated.
Yeah, well, it's what we do. But you can get a hold of us. You can leave voicemails at 210-802-1477. Hit us up on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio. Feedback at GallifreyPublicRadio.com is where you can email us. We're on Facebook, iTunes comments, the show notes, the comments on the show notes. Get discussions going there. Get your opinions to us any way that you possibly can.
Great. So. Thank you for the few folks who have chimed in to give us some contribution on the discussion this week. Kodiak, appreciate your feedback on that. Badger and Soleil as well. SB and some of the other folks who have jumped in to just be able to say, it's good to know that the Doctor's relationship with his companions is constantly in a state of flux, because just as he regenerates, we expect our understanding of who's across the console from him to change as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been episode 75 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, are you my mummy?
And this is Gear saying, I don't really know why I like you so much. It's because you have a wonderful taste.
Yeah. See you next week.
Honestly.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@GallifreyPublicRadio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail.
You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also, make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.